Welcome to Real Personal Finance. I'm your host, Scott Frank, founder of Stone Steps Financial.
And I'm your host, Meg Bartelt, founder of Flow Financial Planning.
The premise of our show is simple.
Money can be confusing, but it doesn't have to be.
Our goal is to answer real personal financial questions that we hear from our clients and our listeners.
Each episode, we answer one personal financial question in a clear and understandable way. Because money is a tool, and when you understand the language of money,
you can make better decisions to improve your daily financial life. Welcome to another week of Real Personal Finance. Last time we chatted about what to do with a pile of cash. Mm-hmm. And so this time, I think we should talk about the other pile that people show up with when they come work with us, a pile of stock.
I was going to say, that sounds very scatological, but yes, pile of stock.
Yes. And the question always is, what do I do? Is it okay? How should I handle this? So I thought we could dive into that today.
Sounds like an excellent thing to dive into because yes, a third of the people who come to us to work with us have this problem, challenge, opportunity, however you want to label it.
Yeah, it is. It is a problem, a challenge, and an opportunity. It is all
there we go.
Yeah.
All the words.
And similar to what we chatted about last week, sometimes there's a touch of a paralysis around it. It's like, okay, so I've been getting these, like, usually we see two things, right? They've been getting publicly traded companies, restricted stock units, they've been vesting, they do that thing called sell to cover. And that just means that, you know, the vest happens and the company withholds some shares for taxes and I get the rest of the shares and they go in this account and then they just kind of accumulate. Mm-hmm. Maybe I turned on the employee stock purchase program as well. So mm-hmm. I have like my shares that I can, you know, go ahead and buy at that discount a couple of times a year. And those are showing up in the account as well. And I've just kind of grown this naturally over time. And here it is. And I'm like, well, what do I do with it?
We definitely see clients who, because of their sort of high compensation levels and also just because their company stock has done well, you know, if you've worked for Apple, for example, for the last 8 years and never sold any of your RSUs, it's done really well by mm-hmm. you. And it's been this sort of steady but aggressive accumulation over many years. And then the yep. other kind of person is if you go through an IPO and all of a sudden you own sort of $0 of company stock on one day and $2 million of it the next day.
Right. Because there's this thing called like double trigger RSUs where like we kind of had these RSUs that were accumulating, but they weren't really ours yet until there is a specific moment. And then all of a sudden they are ours and right. Whoa, what just happened? So when people come to us, I have some thoughts on it for sure. The first thing that I think about when someone comes to us with a pile of stock mm-hmm. is let's have a conversation about perhaps let's stop making the pile get bigger for a little while.
Yes, that is absolutely the first thing to do. If you're still working at the company, this is a challenge because, as you said, the ESPP is going on, the RSUs are continuing to vest. And it's genuinely amusing to me how simple that solution is, mm-hmm. how easily clients accept it, mm-hmm. and how generally they've never even thought of that before.
Yeah.
Despite how sort of simplistic it is.
Yeah. And so just to touch on that briefly, just as a reminder, because sometimes even people who've been around stock comp for a while, it's like, it just gets confusing, right? So like restricted stock units, the moment that they vest, so if you have 100 shares vest, you know, today, and you have sell to cover as your chosen option for how the shares are going to be received. Mm-hmm. Let's just say that 30 to 40 of those shares are going to get put off to the side and used for taxes. And you'll see that show up on your pay stub because what happens is the moment the 100 shares vest, you get ordinary income for the 100 shares that day. Mm-hmm. So you just pay taxes. And then some of those funds are set aside to pay those taxes. And then you get the rest of the shares, right? So the important thing to remember is that's you literally just had compensation that day. It's not like because people will come in and worry about, well, what's my short-term and long-term capital gain on my RSUs that just vested? And the answer is like, well, you don't actually have to have that.
Incorrect right? premise. It was all ordinary income.
Right. Like it's ordinary income. But one thing that you can do if you want to stop growing your pile of cash is you can literally just set, in many cases, some cases the company won't allow it. You actually have to manually go in and do this. But in many cases, you can go change from sell to cover to you just say sell all shares.
Yeah. Like I know Google year and a half ago rolled out this automatic sale program because their RSUs vest every month, but their trading window only occurs every quarter. So even if you were on board for selling your RSUs as soon as they vest manually, you would have to hold them for a month or two before you could sell them. And the automatic sale program allows you to automatically sell them, as the name implies.
Which is amazing. Like because one of the questions you really want to ask with RSUs is, if I receive this money from Google, do I want to buy Google stock with it immediately? And if the answer is no, well, then choosing to move it to 100% sell is great. You're saying, I want the cash instead so I can do other things in my life. I think the other thing you could look to do there while you're doing that is you could see if you're allowed to adjust your tax withholding. And what we mean by that is the government says that, hey, on these sell to covers, hey, Google or whatever company you are, you have to withhold 22% for federal withholding. Well, most people that we see at our firms and probably most of you are going to be at higher tax rates than that. So like if you're in the 32% bracket marginally, you could go set your withholding to 32%. And now all of a sudden you don't have that gap, that 10% gap on all those shares that you're going to owe at the end of the year. Now you just took care of it ahead of time, which usually reduces burden for clients as well, because they don't like having surprise tax bills at the end of the year.
Or having to pay estimated taxes manually throughout the year to make up for that 10% under withholding. Exactly. Yeah, that's actually been a very exciting development in a lot of the large tech companies over the last really just couple years, that they're allowing their employees to withhold more for federal taxes on their RSU vests. Yeah. I recommend that almost universally to my clients.
I think we could also touch on ESPPs briefly. So if you're in an employee stock purchase program and you don't want to make this bigger, what you could choose to do is just simply choose to sell the shares the moment that they become available to you. Now, there may be a trading window to deal with there. But by doing so, what you're going to do is you're essentially going to say, hey, I want that 15% discount, but I just want it to be ordinary income for me. So I'm basically going to pick up a little bit of difference. It basically turns out to be like a really nice high yield savings account for about $25,000 a year. But it's a simple way. Or you could choose to even turn it off if you didn't want that.
Yeah. ESPPs, yeah, they are ironically both the most complicated form of equity compensation, in my opinion, and the least remunerative.
Yeah. You're literally just getting
a few thousand bucks a year.
Yeah. If it's a 10% discount, you're getting $2,500 discount, right? So if you're in a 50% tax bracket, you sell immediately, you made an extra $1,250.
Right.
Yep. Not bad, but the question is, how much work did I have to do for that 12?
How much is that going to move the needle for you? Yeah, I actually have a client who gets gonzo RSUs. He just chooses to not participate because it's the pain in the butt factor is too high.
Now, if we switch to, so that's where we can stop kind of growing the pot.
Yes.
But then we have these shares that already exist. So we need to think through, what do we do with the shares that we already have? What frame do you want to use for that?
I think the framework that we use to discuss what to do with a giant pile of cash is a great one to start with.
Yep.
The what do I need to do with this money, ought to and want to? Because again, taxes are always going to be the need to.
Yes.
And as we were just discussing, it's very likely that if you get RSUs or ESPPs and sell them, you likely still owe more taxes on them. And it's very appropriate for you to pay those taxes out of the exact shares of stock that created the tax liability in the first place.
Totally agree. Yeah. We like to do that with clients all the time.
And then there was the ought to that we discussed, and that's about, you know, do you have an adequate or even ample emergency fund? Do you have any high interest debt that you should pay off? And then we get to the fund too. And that's the the motivating things. Like, if I sold this stock, what could I do with the money after I take care of all the needs and oughts? And that is actually where I find people are very easily persuaded to sell their stock. If they know that they can instantly have a down payment for a home, or instantly fund their kids' college fund, or instantly take that trip of a lifetime to Europe or wherever they want, people generally are very willing to start selling company stock if they can really see what kind of life they can have with the money they get from it.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's like when you can tie where the money's going to go, mm-hmm. With the stock, it makes it so much easier to move on, because it doesn't feel like ethereal. You're like, well, what does this actually mean? And then there's also the tax side of it. We're like, you're going to owe something by selling it. And you're like, do I just keep it? Because, I just want to keep it because then I don't have to pay anything.
And it's done so well for me this far. And, what if I sell it and it continues to go up and, oh my God, I'll feel bad.
And for that purpose, I think we could briefly touch on like two things. One, concentration. So like, how much concentration do we feel is maybe appropriate? And of mm-hmm. course, this is at the client's discretion. So we're going to have recommendations. Mm-hmm. But then two, the other thing is there's this, one of the things I always want to chat with clients about is, well, how often are you getting refreshes on restricted stock? Because if you're always getting restricted stock refreshes each year, you really have two components of stock. You have the stock on your balance sheet, mm-hmm. and then you have this unvested portion that's sitting off the balance sheet, right? It's not yours yet, but it will be yours on probably a quarterly basis, mm-hmm. and it's going up and down in value just as the stock is. So you're still participating. You just may not see it on your balance sheet.
It's persuasive to sell, to recommend selling stock if the person can see what that money is going to do directly mm-hmm. in their life. Mm-hmm. And then you brought up this issue of concentration, and that's much more of a heady academic investment nerd theoretical reason to sell stock. It is not emotionally persuasive unless you're some rare finance nerd type who gets excited about efficient market hypotheses and all that.
Yeah. The emotion behind it is the fear factor, right? It's the Enrons of the world, the WorldComs, which really happened when we were growing up, mm-hmm. right? The Kodak becoming totally irrelevant. It's the idea that like, it's easy for us to think that, especially in the tech phase or tech space, like many of these companies, like they're so dominant right now, it's hard to fathom them not being dominant in the future.
Yeah.
Right. As an aside, my mom worked for Motorola her entire life. Mm. And Motorola went through phases of boom and bust, of being amazing top company, starting in the radio space, then moving to analog phones. They dominated until digital came along and they missed it. Mm. Right. And so like I've seen it play out to the point where I'm like, I'm always worried for clients when they have large concentrated positions in one position, because it could, it can lead to more upside? Absolutely.
Yep.
But it kind of comes back to me of looking at the ought to's. It's like, hey, how much do we need to have for you to not have to worry about working anymore?
Right.
Let's build a portfolio that we know is designed to be, nothing's ironclad, but far more resilient than owning one position, so that you don't have to worry.
Right. Right.
Still have fun with the other concentration.
Yeah. I think that gets at the idea of concentration builds wealth. I mean, mm-hmm. you and I both know this in our own businesses where, we concentrate a lot of our assets in our businesses and grow wealth that way.
100%.
Build wealth by holding a lot of their company stock. Diversification protects and grows just in a sort of a more stable, less volatile way, the wealth that you've gotten by holding on to, 90% of your net worth is in your Airbnb stock or what have right. you.
Way more like watching grass grow or paint dry.
Yes, it still grows.
And being exciting.
Yeah. But, as we were talking about this isn't persuasive, this idea of concentration is a risk in your portfolio. We need to reduce it to reduce the risk in your portfolio. And, you know, best practices suggest that no more than 5% of your investment portfolio should be in any one asset. You know, this is most likely to get you to your investment goals years down the road. I mean, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
That's even if people understand it, it's
not. Yeah, you're like, whatever, dude.
Yeah, it's not emotionally persuasive.
No, I think that the persuasion there, if it does exist there, is tying it back to the fact that it's about having more security and more, what's the proper word? More clarity on the outcome than not, right? That's probably it. It's fun. It's choosing to say that it's funding a goal for their life rather than talking about diversification. Yeah. I agree. Talking about diversification and concentration is boring.
Yeah.
And I think like 5 to 10% totally makes sense. And if people understand that, like, if this goes to zero, my question is always like, if this goes to zero, is it going to affect your life?
Right. So that's brings up a couple of ideas for me. One is, look, you've got this giant pile of stock. You don't have any particular needs for it right now.
Right.
You've got, you know, kids' college is funded. You can pay for your travel desires out of your ongoing, you know, salary. You've already bought your house. Like, life's good. You don't need a giant pile of infused money to do something you've been missing out on. That really means that you can take more risk by holding on to more of this company's stock. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. If we make sure that maybe we take some out to, as you say, sort of secure this goal of long-term financial independence.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a lot of wealth already, I mean, relative to your situation, then at least in my practice, when I'm working with a client, I'm going to be less insistent on, no, seriously, you have to sell. It is dangerous to stay in this concentration. You have the money to gamble, basically, is what I'm saying. Because the rest of your financial life is so robust.
And I think that comes down to the speed with which you kind of have, you're like, whoa, hold on. Like you're behind. You need to catch up. This money can help you catch up. Let's be really prudent right now and let's go fill these goals to make sure that you're okay if they're there. To the point that you're saying is someone's essentially on the other side of that, where it's like life's rosy. It's your choice how much you want to gamble, and gamble away. And I think that they're kind of on a spectrum, right? And it's about helping people understand where are they on that spectrum and identify the goals that they want to be, aiming for and using these funds to help fill those goals.
Yeah. And one particular client, a couple come to mind, because this can be an issue when you have a couple.
Sure.
One person works at the company, has gone through the IPO, has all this company stock, and has that emotional attachment to it. Mm-hmm. You know, the stock's done well for them. They have an emotional attachment to the company. The spouse perhaps does not and wants to get rid of the stock, broadly diversify, because they, you know, they're more sort of emotionally attached to the idea of safety and steady growth as opposed to volatile, possible huge growth. So that's really something to keep in mind. If you're part of a family, these choices need to be made in coordination with your partner.
Absolutely. You know, when people are looking to slim down the portfolio, the way that we will look at it is we'll go look first at, you know, like what has the, in a sense, the, you know, what's long, ideally long-term, that has the least amount of gain built into it, right? So how can we sell the most without impacting the most in tax, if that makes sense? Mm-hmm. I think we'll also think about people sometimes in this instance will look to donate some shares if they're charitable giving. So another way that you can look to decrease your position is you might want to accelerate your giving through a donor advised fund. So I'm just going to make up a number that maybe you normally give $3,000 a year to charities. Mm-hmm. Maybe you choose, if you're going to try to decrease a position quickly, to donate $30,000 to charities. So you're going to load 10 years of giving in 1 year of taxes, because you can give inside of the donor advised fund over the rest of the 10 years, right? Or for the rest of your life. But now what you're doing is by giving, you're creating, again, more of a tax deduction that you can offset with more sales. So I think there's a number of ways we can look to reduce the position.
Yeah, absolutely. I find this especially with people who go through IPOs, because there's this 1 year that's really high income.
Mm-hmm.
And so giving to charity in that year is particularly tax efficient, tax optimized. And so we have to divide, you know, that you have 1,000 shares of your company stock. You're going to keep some of them, you're going to donate some of them, and you're going to sell some of them. And then mm-hmm. we have to figure out. And this is really where we come in with our clients, with the actual targeted advice of sell these shares, hold mm-hmm. these shares, and donate these shares, because that's going to be the most tax optimized way of doing it. Yeah. Up until this point in the conversation with the client, we're sort of guiding the conversation, but the client's actually the one making the decisions
mm-hmm.
because they're the ones who understand best what their values and goals and ideal life are.
Mm-hmm.
But here's, I think, where typically it's much more conversation driven by me, the financial advisor, because I understand the tax implications of all these different shares that you've gotten over the years at different prices.
And, you know, if someone is, maybe they're struggling, they know they want to sell, mm-hmm. but they're struggling to sell.
Mm-hmm.
I think you and I both have a thought on this. What do you think?
Yeah. Again, I find the struggling to sell crops up more when there's not a really obvious, immediate, emotionally mm-hmm. relevant need for the money, mm-hmm. right? This is I need to diversify out of it to sort of boost my retirement savings in a sort of safer, less volatile way, something like that. They know they should be doing this, as opposed to, yay, balloons and rainbows, let's do it. So the way I usually approach it is, great, 90% of your net worth is in your company stock, which often happens if you're, you know, earlier in your career and you go through an IPO. You don't have a lot of money, and then all of a sudden you've got a bunch of money and it's all in company stock. You've got 90% of your wealth in company stock. Best practices is really no more than 5, you know, maybe, as you say, go up to 10. I usually don't start with the recommendation that, hey, let's get down to 5%, right? Because that is just oftentimes too big of a mental hurdle for people.
Yes, that's a big chunk to go from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say, some of my clients, I get through this whole like nuanced conversation. They're just like, can we just sell it all now? I'm like, yes, we can. I love you. But that's a rare client. So I will basically just try to lower the psychological hurdle as much as possible and say, okay, well, let's just sell, you know, 1/12 of your shares each of the, you know, next 12 months, so that we get out of it over the course of a year. And no one sale do you have to worry about it being at a, you know, the lowest price of the year.
Agreed.
Sort of, as you said, I think reverse dollar cost averaging.
Yeah, you're literally like reverse dollar cost averaging, right? So it's like getting rid of the fear of like, oh, I'm going to sell and then it's going to double in price over the next year. And it's like, well, if you just sell a little bit every single month or every quarter, whatever that nuance is that you want to get out of, you're going to hit it along the way. And I think you'd pointed out earlier when we were just chatting before this, that you can also set limits. You can set price targets for yourself if you really want to. That adds a layer of complication, but you can do that. So you can say, hey, we're going to sell this percentage so long as it stays above this dollar amount. And then we'll reassess if it goes below or something like that.
Yeah. At my whole, like you said, you can sort of get as nuanced and detailed and complicated in the sales strategy as you want. But my whole goal in this is let's just sell some. Let's just get it started. Because oftentimes there's this psychological barrier and we just want to burst through that. And what I often find is once a client starts selling their company mm-hmm. stock, they see that they don't die. They see that they don't get attacked by a wild tiger. They see that, you know, their net worth doesn't go to zero. I'm like, oh, okay. Now that I've actually experienced a taste of it, and it's fine.
Yeah.
Nothing bad happened. They're like, oh, okay, we can, you know, do it more quickly, or just let's just continue exercising or operating along this strategy. But it's so much easier emotionally for them at that point.
Yeah. I think we covered this pretty well for what to do with a pile of stock. Hopefully everyone knows what to do now.
Exactly. No more questions.
No more questions. We would love your questions. If you have questions, please go to realpersonalfinance.co and hit submit a question. Happy to answer that. And we'll see you guys next time. Thanks, Meg.
Bye, Scott.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Real Personal Finance Podcast. Enjoying the show?
Let us know by submitting a review. If you have a question that you'd like us to answer on a future episode,
then please head over to Real Personal Finance website at realpersonalfinance.co.
And look for the section at the bottom of each page where you can submit a question.
Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and should not be relied upon for a basis for investment decisions. This podcast is not engaged in rendering financial, legal, or other professional services.